Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. And this is going to be a particularly rich intelligence briefing, I think, because we're going to be speaking with one of the preeminent investigative reporters of our time. He is Paul Sperry. These days, I'm pleased to say, he's associated with us at the counterjihad.com site, where he is the editor-in-chief. He is also a columnist for the New York Post, a longtime editorial and investigative reporter, as I say, with a number of books to his credit, including two that we're going to focus on in particular today. First, Infiltration: How Muslim Spies and Subversives Have Penetrated Washington. And the second, Muslim Mafia: Inside the Secret Underworld That's Conspiring to Islamize America. Paul Sperry, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Good to have you back.
Hey, great to be visiting with you again, Frank.
Listen, there's so much to talk about. I hardly know where to begin, but I think I'd like to set the stage for much of what we'll be talking about in the course of this special hour-long edition of Secure Freedom Radio is the Saudis, the government of Saudi Arabia, the royals, the businesses, the charities, the Sharia-adherent Wahhabists and the like that are of late a bit in the news again, notably as a result of the release of these so-called 28, actually 29 pages from a congressional report done after 9/11. You've looked at this with your usual careful eye. Tell us a little bit about what was in those 29 pages and what we've learned from them.
Well, the biggest revelation, the biggest takeaway from those pages that, you know, a lot was leaked, as you know, Frank, a lot was leaked before these came out. Some of the information leaked accurately, some not. But, you know, some of this stuff is a little bit known, not really by the average American, but it's been leaked out in the Washington press a little bit. But the biggest takeaway that no one knew was the substantive links between top al-Qaeda leaders directly, indirectly to this former Saudi ambassador, Prince Bandar, who left the U.S. about 2005, but he was the ambassador in the run-up to the 9/11 attacks and thereafter. And Bandar, turns out, was almost on a speed dial with the number three al-Qaeda leader over in Afghanistan and Pakistan. What happened was the FBI tracked down some numbers that were found from this leader who was captured over there. Abu Zubaydah was his name, and he's now at Kidmo. But they found unlisted numbers for Bandar, and not only in his mansion, not only in the embassy in D.C., but for his private residence in Aspen, Colorado, which just is chilling. And there's new information that he gave money directly to some of these Saudi intelligence agents who were handling the hijackers as they came into the United States through California.
Now, when you say he, you're talking there about Prince Bandar, the Saudi ambassador to the United States for many years.
That's right. What was leaked from this report was that his wife had given money for medical reasons to another wife of one of the these intelligence agents in San Diego who were helping the hijackers. But as it turns out, there was tens of thousands of dollars going directly from Bandar's rigged bank account to the Saudi intelligence officers who were directly handling the hijackers. So that's new information. So really the biggest, the most shocking piece of information on the 28 pages is how it ties Bandar into the hijackers and the Al-Qaeda and the whole 9/11 plot. That is all new, and that should be investigated, because Bandar was never so much as a footnote in the 9/11 Commission report, which came out after the 28 pages were classified, censored, 2 years earlier, 2-3 years earlier, in the Congressional Inquiry Report. So there was no follow-up, it seems, on Bandar. From what I understand, he wasn't even questioned about this, and they never pursued those numbers. They this was so politically sensitive that the field office in Denver just handed it up and said, look, we know this is so radioactive, we're not going to even touch this anymore.
Paul Sperry, you have, of course, been studying these issues for decades and writing on them extensively and trying wherever possible to connect the proverbial dots. Let me just ask you pointedly the question that I think would be on the minds of most of people listening to you. Does what you've just described constitute really a smoking gun with respect to the involvement of certainly senior Saudi officials, apparently agents as well, in the attacks that killed nearly 3,000 Americans on 9/11 in 2001?
Well, the 28 pages, two things. One, 28 pages, there's no one single piece of information that in there that can be considered a smoking gun. But when you take all the data points together, there's so many of them in there. And by the way, this is my second point, that these are just summaries of the CIA and the FBI case file reports. This isn't the raw data. So it could be much worse than we're seeing in those 28 pages. That's a summation of the evidence. So, but when you take it all together, all the information is so reinforcing, and there's so much of it, and there's so many Saudi officials involved. And then you get to Bandar, and we've been told, oh, well, maybe these were some rogue elements within the Saudi government that were operating off on their own because, they had some type of affinity or sympathy for bin Laden or whatever. No, this went pretty high up. I mean, it's the highest level you can go in the United States for the Saudi government, the Saudi embassy. And then you had a Saudi consulate official, a guy named Thumairy, who was heading the Islamic Affairs Office out of Los Angeles, who was directly involved. So, no, this seemed to have been a conspiracy, at least inside the U.S., to help the hijackers. Whether or not we don't have a direct tie, at least not in the material that we're seeing now in the 28 pages. And keep in mind, too, that an aggregate of about three whole pages out of the 29 pages were redacted. Still, so we have a lot of stuff we still don't know, and a lot of that stuff, those blackout sections, whole paragraphs, and a lot of it around when we're talking about Bandar.
Yeah, and let's just recall that Bandar Bush was the nickname that was given to Prince Bandar by, I think, among others, the Bush family, which was very close to him and had been for quite some time. And Paul Sperry, one of the other names that appears in this 28, 29 pages is Turki Alfaisal. Now, you rightly point out that most of this dot connecting seems to involve the folks here in the United States. But Turki Alfaisal, who subsequently became the U.S. ambassador, the Saudi ambassador to the United States, but he was head of Saudi intelligence during this period, was he not?
Yes. Yeah, so you have Prince Turki, head of intel. And that was his portfolio for the ministry, for the Saudi government out of Riyadh. He is he was the brother-in-law at the time of Bandar, and Bandar's father, Prince Sultan, was the head of defense and aviation. And so then you go back to San Diego and you look at these two Saudi intelligence officers who are very key to the conspiracy there, at least with some of the hijackers who attacked the Pentagon, who came in through San Diego, and they were set up nicely, and they had a whole advance team for them through the Saudi consulate. Well, these guys were working for cutouts companies, shell companies, as their cover, as intelligence officers for the Saudi defense ministry and for aviation.
Yeah, it certainly sounds, Paul, we have to pause for just a second. We'll come right back. But it certainly sounds as though there were connections all the way back into Riyadh and the Saudi government itself, involving it, implicating it in this 9/11 attack, at least indirectly. Paul, we have to pause. We'll be right back with more with Paul Sperry of counterjihad.com right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. According to the New York Times, President Obama said during a rare visit to the CIA to discuss the second phase in the battle against ISIS on April 13th, that the U.S.-led coalition had momentum against ISIS and that ISIS fighters realize their cause is lost. But the previous day, the New York Times ran a story with the headline, ISIS expands reach despite military and financial setbacks, noting that although ISIS has suffered losses on the ground in Iraq and Syria, it has expanded its presence in northern Africa, Afghanistan, and Europe. There also has been little progress in stopping ISIS's efforts to recruit homegrown terrorists worldwide. The president is in denial about the threat from ISIS. His trip to the CIA, which should have occurred 5 years ago when the violence broke out in the Middle East, was little more than a publicity stunt. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We're talking for a full hour, I'm very pleased to say, with Paul Sperry, the editor-in-chief of counterjihad.com, also a columnist for the New York Post and the author of several really important books, including Infiltration, How Muslim Spies and Subversives Have Penetrated Washington, and Muslim Mafia, Inside the Secret Underworld That's Conspiring to Islamize America. Paul, we've been talking about the Saudis, the insights that we had into what appears to have been a role they played in the 9/11 attacks. You were just describing that this is evidence that suggests indirectly ties, using cutouts, using, well, the tradecraft of espionage, I'd say, to perhaps conceal some of their involvement. But the dots properly connected, it would seem, even in this redacted 29-page document, is pretty damning, is it not?
Yeah. I mean, you have everybody who, the FBI and the CIA, who were who quoted the reports in this 29 pages, they're talking about these two Saudi nationals who were in San Diego as intelligence officers, and so they would have worked directly through the intelligence ministry, and that's Prince Turki, that's his portfolio, and then you have and that's the brother-in-law of Bandar. Bandar's father, at the same time, is Prince Sultan. He's overseeing the defense and aviation cutouts that these guys were working for as cutouts. That's where they were getting their money, big gobs of money. They didn't work. Everybody who knew them said they didn't actually work and for these companies, and yet they were getting paid a lot of money. Money then was also coming in through the Saudi embassy from Bandar's personal accounts as well. So you have really a troika there of Prince Sultan, Prince Turki, and Prince Bandar that are indirectly connected to this 9/11 conspiracy and the hijackers. So,
and it's just unbelievable to me that this has not received closer scrutiny, a public debate before now. Paul, your contributions to this at counterjihad.com with an excellent précis of what is in that 29 pages is really appreciated. Paul, you have been, as I've indicated, involved for many years in trying to figure out what the nature of this global jihad movement is, not just historically, but what it's up to at the moment. How would you characterize the role being played by the government of Saudi Arabia and its nationals in that global jihad at the moment?
Well, since we never got to the bottom of their role in 9/11, clearly there was a terrorism support network set up in infrastructure that involves not just the Saudi embassy, but the consulates, but also their Saudi-funded mosques. And that really becomes apparent when you read those 29 pages, that the mosques were involved in, you know, money laundering, terror support. The hijackers went to a lot of back and forth bi-coastal to Saudi funded, Saudi built mosques. And, who were these people? Were they all kicked out of the country? Were they deported? Are they still in place in the embassy and the consulates? Are they still in place in the mosques? We don't know, because no one got to the bottom of what the Saudi role in 9/11 was. And, you know, quite frankly, we need to have another, reopen the 9/11 commission at a minimum, because obviously they missed a lot. They did not connect the dots when it came to the Saudis, if you read that report. And no one has refuted any of this information that's in the 29 pages. In other words, no one's come in and said, no, this is totally inaccurate. These bank accounts, these bank records, these phone records, these are all, garbage. No, it's all there. It just was never pursued aggressively to get to the next layer.
And yet there has been some effort made, including, I'm thinking, by the co-chairman of the 9/11 Commission, Governor Tom Kaine of New Jersey, and Lee Hamilton, former congressman, to sort of poo-poo this material in the 28 pages, both historically and more recently. And again, I think this is interesting and important to get sorted, no question about it. But let me just ask you about the present danger. And you've mentioned Saudi financing of U.S. mosques. Paul Sperry, would you talk about how that financing takes place and what control over the mosques it translates into for a kingdom that is evidently pretty damn hostile to the United States?
Extremely. And we haven't even talked about the immigration jihad they're doing. But let me go back to, to Hamilton and Kaine. Hamilton, at least, has publicly admitted he's never even read the 29 pages. This is before they were declassified. So, I mean, it sounds like the co-chairman of the 9/11 Commission didn't even know about them. And yet they're trying to poo-poo them. So they never even personally read them when they had the opportunity when they were doing that investigation.
Yeah, especially since they're making public pronouncements about it or were before.
I mean, it's all very, very strange. Anyway, so on the mosque front, the money comes in, a lot of it comes in through the North American Islamic Trust. It's a big Saudi-funded, it's basically the bank for the Muslim Brotherhood in America. This is a group that's based out of Illinois, and they are the trustee. They hold the keys to most of the mosques and almost all of the radical mosques that are factories for jihadists in this country. If you look at some of the worst mosques in this country, like Dar al-Hijra, the 9/11 hijackers mosque, and just outside of Washington, they are owned and controlled. The deeds are owned by NAIT, N-A-I-T, North American Islamic Trust. And there's, of course, a lot of other ways, entities through which the money is laundered into these, into the terror support networks.
What does the control by NAIT translate into in terms of, what's preached in those mosques, by whom, the curriculums for the various madrasas associated with these mosques, and so on, Paul Sperry?
Yeah, the control is financial, it's doctrinal, as you say, and it's personnel. I mean, they control who gets to be the prayer leaders and who sit on the board, the trustees, the directors of these mosques. If you look into their background, they're all Muslim Brotherhood figures going way back to when they first came into this country. under the Muslim Students Association. And, we, you know, of course, you know this is a forerunner of ISNA. And
the Islamic Society of North America, right. And, Paul, to the extent that these groups, the Islamic Society of North America, the Muslim Students Association, the North American Islamic Trust, and the like, have benefited from funding from Saudi Arabia, how is that provided? I keep hearing about something called the Muslim World League, and what role does it play?
Yeah, the Muslim World League is actually is a Saudi government entity. Saudis are trying, you know, once they got in trouble and there was a movement to get them designated as a foreign terrorist organization. There was a lot of lobbying, counter lobbying by the Saudi lobby, K Street, to try and stop that from happening. And one of their ways they did that was, oh no, this is just a charity. No, it's directly controlled in Riyadh by the kingdom.
And funded, and as I understand it, funded as a line item in the royal budget. Hey, Paul, we have to pause for another second. We'll come back with more with this Muslim World League and what it says about what the Saudis do and will do if not stopped inside America. That and more with Paul Sperry, the editor-in-chief of CounterJihad.com and also a columnist for the New York Post, right after this.
Visit us at Facebook.com/SecureFreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Yesterday, Donald Trump delivered the best speech of his campaign to date. Newt Gingrich rightly called it the most important since Ronald Reagan left office. In fact, in many ways, it was Reaganesque in its clarity about today's existential threat to freedom, what Trump calls radical Islam, and his prescription for securing the sort of victory over it that President Reagan achieved over the last such threat, Soviet communism. Mr. Trump called for a comprehensive strategy aimed at protecting us against the hateful ideology Islamic supremacists call Sharia. Those who do not share our values and seek to supplant our Constitution with Sharia would not be welcome here, and he would roll up the networks in this country that support Islamist radicalization. The stage is now set for the sort of national debate and choice that is long overdue and absolutely necessary. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're having what I call an intelligence briefing of the first order from Paul Sperry, one of the country's best intelligence and national security reporters, investigative reporters of our time. He is also an accomplished author, including two books that we're focusing on at the moment, Infiltration, How Muslim Spies and Subversives Have Penetrated Washington, and Muslim Mafia Inside the Secret Underworld That's Conspiring to Islamize America. Paul, we were talking a moment ago about the role that the Saudi government plays, not just historically, but as we speak, in funding activities that are supportive of, the Muslim Brotherhood and its various front organizations and the toxic brew that they are creating in the guise of what they call civilization jihad inside the United States, a kind of stealthy jihad. And it's funded, at least in part, by the government of Saudi Arabia through this so-called Muslim World League. This would seem to be a direct assault on the United States by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Am I missing something here?
They're financing subversive activities in this country, and yet we consider them still an ally. It's outrageous. But the Muslim World League has been tied to al-Qaeda. They propagate jihadi materials to the Islamic schools and the mosques here in the U.S. They propagate Wahhabism in America. They're importing a seditious and violent culture, ideology, into this nation to try to turn America into an Islamic state. That is the ultimate goal. And the other thing, the other piece of this, what they're doing is they're doing immigration jihad, and they're trying to get as many, first of all, Saudi nationals as they can into our college campuses, where they've, of course, then in turn join the Muslim Students Association, which is this jihadist front group, and get all these young other Muslims either recruited or converts non-Muslims to this Islamism. And I discovered that through just the data, and no one's looked at this, that under Hillary Clinton's reign there at the State Department, the floodgates were opened for student visas from Saudi Arabia. We really put the kibosh on that after we found out that some of the hijackers got in on student visas. They were rubber stamped through this Visa Express program we had set up with Saudi Arabia, where we didn't even really do any serious screening in advance with, you know, of their application. So we didn't know who was coming in. So we said, well, okay, let's stop that. And then we had this dearth in visa issuances from 2001 to about 2008, 2009. All of a sudden, an inflection point right there. Boom, you have this hockey stick that just shoots right up, the handle of the hockey stick, if you can envision that, under the Obama regime and under Hillary. She's the one who's doing this, approving this change in policy. But what's really alarming about, by the way, over 700,000 new student visas and business visas for Saudi nationals have been rubber stamped under Obama, 700,000.
Just to be clear, what you're describing is the wholesale reversal, it sounds like, of policies that were quite sensibly adopted after 9/11 to try to restrict the inflow of Saudi nationals, many of them young men, seeking, among other kinds of studies in this country, flight training. Just obviously, in the wake of 9/11, quite sensible. What possible grounds could there have been for undoing those restrictions and admitting, you know, 700,000 folks, including some of those I've just described?
Well, the official line was, you know, this is good for business, but we don't know. We can't track this is virtually all young Saudi men. The women don't get the student visas to come over here to get educated. These are all young Saudi men, just like the 15 hijackers.
And jihadist age, one might say.
Jihadist age. They fit the profile. Come over here. We don't do the NCERS program anymore, where we used to do, you know, marginal tracking of them when they came in to see if they actually went to where they said they were going, and then that they actually left when their visas were expired after 5 years. No, we don't even do it. We have no idea if they even show up on campus, and they're just flooding by the tens of thousands each month coming in on these student visas. But I mean, this has just replaced. You know, we had this Visa Express program. Everybody was outraged after 9/11 that we had this program at the State Department. We shut down the special program with Saudi Arabia, just rubber stamped them, their applicants to come into the U.S. on these visas. Well, we've just replaced that. We don't call it Visa Express anymore, but now it's called Trusted Travelers. So now we've, under Hillary and under the Homeland Security Department, and almost virtually no American knows this. Saudis are now considered one of the least security risks of any nationality coming into this U.S. They're on par now with Canadians.
That's simply unbelievable.
French and Germans aren't even in the Trusted Travelers program, but the Saudis are now. And that happened, and one of the last acts that Hillary did in 2013 when she left was she signed off on this and had special meetings. The story's up on Counter Jihad. We have the photographs of her with the Interior Minister of Saudi Arabia coming over here. They're signing deals on this day that this happened. It's outrageous.
And
it was never covered.
And as you say, Paul, the so-called National Security Entry Exit Registration System, NSEERS, was over the side as well. So essentially we saw this wholesale dismantling of these procedures put into place to try to protect us against the Saudis, and much of it can be tied directly to Hillary Clinton herself. And I just have to ask you, one of the people whose family benefited massively from the Muslim World League's support over the years, and specifically the patronage of the guy who ran it for a long time, Abdullah Omar Nassif, is, of course, Huma Abedin, Secretary of State Clinton's deputy chief of staff for a number of years, her longtime associate, her deputy campaign manager these days. Paul, give us a sense of what Huma Abedin's family business, the Institute for Muslim Minority Affairs, was doing with funding from the Muslim World League, from the government of Saudi Arabia, and whether that may bear in some measure on what kinds of things she was presumably advising Hillary Clinton to do vis-a-vis the Saudis, among other Islamists and Islamic supremacists.
Huma Abedin is her closest advisor. It's just not her body lady, as they describe her, who gets her coffee and all this stuff and her favorite Starbucks. She has untold influence over Hillary now, and she's working on the campaign, and she could end up in the White House in a very senior role. But her father, Saeed Abedin, I'm talking a little bit out of school here because I'm not as well versed in this, but he was recruited by this Saudi official to come to move from, I believe they were in Michigan, Kalamazoo or something. And to move actually to, I believe it was Jeddah. It was either Riyadh or Jeddah to set up this propaganda organ for the Muslim Brotherhood over there, and put out all sorts of propaganda for the Saudis and Islamists.
And specifically, as I understand it, Paul, promote this idea of non-assimilation of Muslim minorities in the West, in the interest of incubating essentially the populations that would help turn those non-Muslim nations into, as you said earlier, Muslim-majority nations. I mean, this sounds kind of unbelievable, but it's the long-term project of the Muslim Brotherhood and of the government of Saudi Arabia, and we have been one of its targets. Paul, we have to pause for just a moment. We'll be right back with more on Huma Abedin, her influence, and the kinds of policies that not only have we seen from Hillary Clinton, but that we might under a president Hillary Clinton. Right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Our guest is Paul Sperry, the editor-in-chief of counterjihad.com and one of the country's preeminent experts on the threats that we're facing, both foreign and domestic, from Islamic supremacists, some of whom have managed to, it seems, infiltrate high levels of government. I'm sorry to say, not just under this administration, but to some extent under the previous as well. And we were talking about one such individual whose family, at the very least, has been very deeply involved in Muslim Brotherhood activities. Her mother has been described as a member of the Muslim Sisterhood. And the question recurs, Paul Sperry, given what we know of Huma Abedin and her background, given what we know of her family's deep involvement with and activities on behalf of the Muslim Brotherhood, and it's not just her father and mother, it's her brother and sister as well, do you think that this constitutes a security threat particularly given the kinds of policies that I presume she has been encouraging Hillary Clinton to adopt over the years, not just with respect to, you know, letting Saudis into the country and, you know, the sort of embrace of the Muslim Brotherhood, but not least this campaign that Hillary's been on to restrict freedom of speech lest it offend Muslims.
Well, she would have the ability to, and she did in states, to promote various individuals into positions of policy at state, being these being Muslims or representatives of the Muslim Brotherhood into positions, and that needs to be investigated. We don't know enough about that. Some of it's starting to come out with these emails to see just how much influence she had in terms of, you know, we're just now finding out that she was the conduit to help, you know, this kind of simony where, you know, somebody at the Clinton Foundation would recommend somebody get an appointment within the State Department or some other agency, and she was the person that would run that up the flagpole to Hillary. And but it, also in terms of promoting the agenda of the Muslim Brotherhood, we don't know how much she's been involved in that, and that needs to be investigated because of her background, not just with her parents, but I believe that, correct me if I'm wrong, that she was actually on staff at this propaganda organ that was published out of Saudi Arabia. She was actually working with her mother as an editor.
Yeah, she was listed as an associate editor, as I recall, for some 12 years on the masthead of their Journal for Muslim Minority Affairs. Exactly right.
Yeah, so if you look at some of the propaganda they put out, you know, somebody has to, you know, if it gets to Hillary getting in and she's in appointed to some position where she has to go before Congress, that's the first question people need to ask. Do you still believe in this stuff? You know, what was your role? Were your connections? That is all fair game because, yes, there is a civilization jihad going on in terms of sabotaging U.S. policy from within, infiltrating the institutions, including the U.S. government agencies. That is all spelled out in the U.S. Muslim Brotherhood's archives, mm-hmm. In their founding documents. So what did she know about
Paul,
this?
I can't conceive of her being submitted to the Senate for confirmation. I'm sure that the kind of position she would get would be one that is not requiring that kind of action by the Senate, you know, the White House chief of staff or deputy chief of staff or something to that effect. Which is even scarier. You're exactly right. But let me ask you about this, Paul. You've written again in your book Infiltration and also in Muslim Mafia about this conspiracy. And there are those who insist that this is not a conspiracy. This is just a conspiracy theory, and that deprecate those of us who are, well, as you say, looking at the evidence from the Muslim Brotherhood's own archives, notably the explanatory memorandum and a document that, among others, was introduced into evidence in a federal prosecution of a prominent Muslim Brotherhood front, the Holy Land Foundation. How do you respond to people who try to dismiss all of this as, well, just a conspiracy theory?
Well, it's definitely not a theory. It's a genuine conspiracy, and it was mapped out by the U.S. prosecutors for the U.S. Department of Justice, and not in just one case, the Holy Land Foundation, but a couple of other cases in Virginia, Northern Virginia. And the evidence is overwhelming, and all the documentation is there. If anybody wants to go to the Holy Land Foundation, that case, and look up all the case files, you can see the documents, you can see the FBI agents' testimony, the prosecutors, and the conclusions they came to. This is what's so alarming to me. I thought about this the other day. If anybody, you know, even Fox News, any of the cable networks, of course, not even the big three networks, have ever even had one of those documents from that explanatory memo, which is one of the most critical documents in our history, uncovered in an investigation of a suspected terrorist, at his home in Annandale, Virginia. They found it in his basement. And he was also a senior member in the U.S. of the Muslim Brotherhood. But anyways, this has not come to light. The average American has never seen this on TV. I just realized that. That's outrageous that this has never been, there's been no special even done on Fox on these documents. They are critical documents to understanding what the goal of the bad guys are in this country. These are the terrorists with suits, not the terrorists with the suicide vest, but with the suit vest, as I say. And they're just as dangerous because they're the support network for the guys who actually blow themselves up and blow us up.
This is such a critical point, Paul, and you've done really incalculably important work in exposing it in your books and in your columns and in your editorials at Investor's Business Daily and of course, in what you're doing these days at counterjihad.com. And I really commend you for it because I think exposing the danger, in some ways, it's more dangerous in a society like ours posed by people who don't pose an overt threat, but instead are able to, through their smooth talking and their profession of moderation, to get their way into government. And talk just for a moment, if you would, we'll have to pause in a bit, but just a bit about what the infiltration of the United States government by these Muslim Brotherhood operatives has meant in terms of their influence on American policy?
Well, I mean, they've gotten into, and this is just hard for anybody who's not versed in all this stuff to get their heads around, but they've actually infiltrated their security complex, not just more benign institutions, but they've actually gotten into the FBI through the translator programs. We've actually had at least two Muslim Brotherhood agents become FBI agents. We have so many that have infiltrated the Arabic translation and Urdu translation programs in the FBI that we have to have constant espionage investigations and other investigations for mistranslations. We have them in the translation program and also some actually soldiers in the Department of Defense. And we, of course, have gotten into advisory roles, as you know, in the Department of Homeland Security, where they're shaping policy there and actually trying to get rid of, scrub out all of the references to jihad and Islam in our training materials for FBI and for Border Patrol and customs agents.
And then we've talked about Homa Abedin and the State Department opening the door to more Saudi nationals and on it goes. Paul, we have to pause for one final break. We'll be right back with more with Paul Sperry of counterjihad.com, the author of Infiltration and Muslim Mafia and more. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to our final installment of this important and deep diving conversation about the Muslim Brotherhood, Islamic supremacism more generally, the global jihad, and the fact that it's here, not just elsewhere, and that it's being waged against us through stealthy means, subversive, what I think of as pre-violent means, as well as the violent ones. Paul Sperry, of course, is one of the country's preeminent investigative journalists. He's been covering this and related national security threats extraordinarily ably for decades. He is an author as well as a columnist and now editor-in-chief of counterjihad.com. Let me ask you about one last piece of this, Paul, because it's been much in evidence of late. And that is an influence operation that we've seen featured prominently at the Democratic National Convention, a fellow by the name of Kaiser Khan. Tell us what you have found in your investigation of Mr. Khan, a Gold Star father, the father of a fallen and, by all accounts, heroic Muslim soldier, that ought to give us all pause, if not more concern.
Well, it turns out this Kaiser Khan, who the media is trying to glorify, is this seasoned lawyer, constitutional expert, you know, with a Harvard law degree, you know, putting Trump and the rest of his supporters in their place about immigration policy. Well, it turns out he's not an expert on constitutional law. He's an expert on Sharia law, and he's had a number of papers that have been cited over and over on Islamic law. He appears to be quite the scholar on the subject. But in terms of his credentials and his academic pedigree, they're not what the media has been putting out there. As it turns out, he hasn't even actually practiced law. And he got his formal law training from a tiny college in Pakistan that's run, the chancellor there is an anti-Semitic 9/11 denier. I believe it's crazy conspiracy stuff. So it's no telling what Khan was taught over in this so-called law school over there in Lahore, Pakistan. But it's just outrageous stuff to see what they believe over there, and this is where he got his stuff. And then it turns out also that at Harvard, he didn't get his JD, his law degree there. He got a master's, and his master's thesis focused on Pakistan and other third world Muslim countries. So, I mean, to say that this guy's this big American lawyer trained in constitutional law, it's just nothing but hype. He's been shilling for Hillary, too. I mean, that's his job. He's shilling for Hillary.
We've seen on a couple of occasions now him brandishing the U.S. Constitution and even choking up over his attachment to it and characterizing what he's been doing, both at the DNC and in the endless stream of information operations, I guess you'd call them, that he's been engaged in since. It suggests that he's not simply been engaged in a kind of flim-flam about his background and his personal record and history, but that this is a fraud of a guy who actually believes, as Sharia commands, that it is the supreme law worldwide, not that man-made stuff like the U.S. Constitution. Am I missing something here, Paul Sperry?
No, and he actually, I found a book report that he wrote on this book that was a compilation of a number of really speeches and addresses by Islamists around the world, and it focused on this conference that took place in Kuwait. The chapter that he pulled out, the one that he said was the hallmark of the book, and praised it as, you know, the successful argumentation, convincing argumentation, was by this guy named Ala Brohi. He was a religious minister in Pakistan, implemented a number of, you know, the brutal punishments over there under Sharia, and believes that, actually says in his writings in this chapter, that it's sanctioned, it's okay to beat your wife. And here, Khan had a chance to say, no, this is not human rights. You don't have the right to beat your wife or to cut off somebody's head because they're an apostate or all these other Sharia, this medieval barbaric stuff. He didn't take that chance. He actually said this is the hallmark of the book, and it was praising this stuff, and yet this guy is supposedly loyal to the Constitution. He loves the Constitution. It just doesn't jive. The guy obviously has an agenda, and no one's getting to the bottom of it in the mainstream media because he's the perfect foil for the whole immigration you know, controlling, curbing immigration from these hostile Muslim countries that are hotspots for ISIS and so forth. So this is really scandalous. But the media, of course, is in his corner, and it's very also hard to criticize him because he did have a genuinely heroic son who's a patriot, by all accounts, who fought in Iraq as a soldier. But by the way, the father tried to talk him out of even joining the military. Let's make that clear. Yeah, and that's not being reported.
Paul Sperry, you've done superb work on this, and I want to commend you for it, not just at counterjihad.com, but also at Breitbart News and elsewhere. And I hope you'll keep it up, because this record does need to be exposed. And the influence operations that Kaiser Khan and his enablers are perpetrating need to be countered. Let me ask you about one other thing, Paul, quickly. Over the weekend, as you know, there was another outburst of this Black Lives Matter violence in connection with a police shooting in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Paul, based on your investigative reporting, what do we know about Black Lives Matter and, in particular, its ties to Islamic supremacists and, of course, anarchists of the Occupy stripe more broadly?
Well, there is some evidence, circumstantial evidence. It's hard to investigate the Black Lives Matter, because it seems like such a diffuse group. There's not really a central, they're not registering as an actual organization. Although the president has actually put one of their founders in charge of helping reform police departments across the country as part of his presidential task force on policing out of the White House. You've probably seen her in some photo ops sitting right next to the president. She's got the seat of honor, which is a little disturbing to say the least. But there are some anecdotal evidence that there's some solidarity between the jihadi groups and ISIS, and actually some merging of interests, maybe possibly some personnel between the Black Lives Matter movement and ISIS. So you have these two very violent groups, homegrown, that could be merging, and the profile of the typical jihadists in America could be changing, as we're seeing. Now, I noticed over the last, just the last month, I believe 4 out of the last 5 major arrests, ISIS suspects who have been charged with material support for ISIS are African American. And so we're starting to see some changes here. We're seeing more recruitment in the Black community by ISIS, and they are actually targeting them. In their some of their papers and some of their videos, they're actually targeting African Americans, so law enforcement has to adjust accordingly. Politicians have to start getting aware of this too.
Amen, and do the rest of us. Paul Sperry, you do more than your fair share to try to keep us all aware of these things. I'm very proud of our association with you, and delighted to have you as the editor in chief of CounterJihad.com. I appreciate your works, books, the innumerable columns and editorials that you've written over the years, and know that the best is yet to come. Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. I hope the rest of you will do so tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.